This episode of The In-Between is intended for mature audiences and includes topics such as emotional, sexual, and physical violence. Testimony shared by guests of the show is their own and does not reflect the views of Mel Barrett or Ruby Grace Productions. Listener discretion is advised.
A Dauphin County woman who says she was sexually assaulted 2 years ago is still waiting for her day in Lebanon County Court. But Veronica Rodriguez is the one on trial now for recording the audio on her cell phone without permission.
As time went on, more and more people reached out to me. They continue to give me their concerns, speak about their personal experiences, the ones of their loved ones. And that really just fueled the fire and brought me out here today.
The woman involved calls it rape. The man calls it consensual.
When you record something like that, you're pretty much also thinking, I might not make out of this alive. It's not just about, are they going to believe that it was rape? It's about, am I going to be turning up as a dead body? And here's the evidence of my rapist and my killer.
If found guilty, she could face 15 years in jail.
People gathered today to protest the Lebanon County District Attorney, Pierre Hescroff, and her alleged mishandling of Veronica Rodriguez's rape case.
I've been struggling, I'm not going to lie. I'm working on a case for season two that tears at the very fabric of my conscience. The case I'm working on is about a convicted rapist whom I believe might not be guilty. That doesn't feel great any way you look at it. Either a rapist has convinced me he's innocent when he's not, or an innocent man has spent the past almost 30 years in prison for crimes he didn't commit. Neither option is good, but I've got to get to the bottom of it to discover the truth. It's the only way I'll be able to let this go. For those of you who've been listening to my podcast for a while, you know that I am very honest about the fact that I am a survivor of sexual abuse and assault. My baseline is always, I believe women. And lately, with verdicts like the one that just came out of New York federal court in the case of the state of New York versus Sean Diddy Combs, I'm falling into having no faith in the system again, and like we're dipping back into the mindset of don't believe women. You see it in the Diddy case, in the Amber Heard versus Johnny Depp case, the Blake Lively versus Baldoni case, in the Netflix documentary by amazing journalist Rachel De Leon, Victim Suspect, and in another case that's popped up on my radar, the case of Veronica Rodriguez, who has been charged and convicted with falsely reporting a sexual assault and felony wiretapping in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I'm struggling because at the base of these cases is a woman not being believed and actually being punished for coming forward about her abuse and or assault when she's collected her own evidence. I'm struggling because I also believe that a convicted rapist might have been railroaded by a system that needed to imprison a boogeyman. I'm struggling because Karen Reed had to pay for two trials to prove her factual innocence, and yet the DA's office in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is still telling the public she's guilty. I'm struggling because on top of digging through the psychological quagmire that is proving sexual assault, I'm also digging through the garbage fire of corruption flowing from several district attorneys' offices and grasping at straws to figure out what the hell I can do about it. So to make one small step in the direction of getting to the truth, in this episode of The In-Between, I'm going to tell you about Veronica Rodriguez. I hadn't planned to make a several episode push about one subject in between seasons, but this story has fallen into my lap and I can't look away from it. Veronica has been tried and convicted of making a false report of sexual assault and felony wiretapping in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. She is awaiting sentencing on August 20th, 2025. It's obvious speaking with Veronica on record might jeopardize her sentencing, so you may not hear from her until after August 20th. But there's a chance we're going to openly speak about her experiences, so stay tuned for that. In the meantime, I have a whole host of folks who are directly involved in the case waiting in the wings, and we'll report what they have to say so you can make up your own mind about Veronica's case. This micro-season is also going to focus on the corruption of the district attorney's office and the investigation that led to prosecutor Pierre Hescroff, a strong woman in her own right, to come out firing at Veronica Rodriguez, who by all accounts is the actual victim in this case. So let's try to get to the bottom of this together, shall we? This is a story about a woman who says she was raped and ended up being the one charged with crimes instead. It's a story about power, perception, and how the criminal justice system can turn on the very people it claims to protect. This is the case of Veronica Rodriguez. Veronica was 26 and working in the dental clinic at Fort Indian Town Gap with the Air National Guard when she met Dr. Fahad Pervez, who said he was new in town, new to the base, and just looking for someone to grab dinner with. He told her he was new to the Air Force, too, Turns out, none of that was true. She agreed to hang out with him, but said she regretted it the moment she pulled into the restaurant parking lot to meet him. According to Veronica, the night ended in the backseat of Fahad's car, with him raping her while she was heavily intoxicated, possibly even drugged. She told her supervisors the sex wasn't consensual, but she wasn't sure she wanted to pursue a rape charge, because most victims aren't believed unless they have evidence. But she did want to come clean to her command. Instead of support, she got suspicion, and before long, she was the one under investigation. Not only did the Fort Indiantown Gap police say she lied, they charged her with filing a false report and two felonies for wiretapping, because she recorded parts of the night on her phone without Fahad's consent. Her defense brought in two experts. One of them, Carl Hirschman, is kind of a big deal in the world of sex crimes investigations. He was featured in the Netflix documentary Victim, Suspect, which is about the growing number of women who report sexual assault and end up charged with making it up.
Most of the victims in sexual assault are between ages of 14 and 26. So you're dealing with somebody that's really young, and they just don't understand how it works. Even adults don't know how it works, but, yeah.
Why do you care so much?
Good question. My sister was sexually assaulted twice. The first time she was 13, she came home. My mom called the police. They did zero. They didn't even take a report. Then my sister got heavily into drugs, and a lot of that was from what happened to her. And she became addicted, and then when she was 17 years old, she was raped by two males and two suspects. Cops came out, did nothing. And my sister just struggled for the rest of her life. And I know it came from that. So I look at my victims and I see her. That's why.
Hirschman reviewed Veronica's case and said the police made assumptions way too early, failed to verify their own conclusions, and skipped key steps in the investigation. Hirschman, from a report he filed with the court as an expert witness, said,
"Sexual-based investigations have their own unique dynamics and cannot be treated like other types of investigations. The investigator should be trained in all aspects of these special dynamics, or they will not be successful. In particular, law enforcement professionals face three fundamental challenges while conducting a sexual assault investigation involving a non-stranger suspect. 1. Most victims do not physically resist a sexual assault. 2. Most victims only report their sexual assault to law enforcement after a delay of some kind or a trigger that forces them to report. 3. Most victims provide some information in their interview that is incomplete, inconsistent, or even untrue. This case had all three of these challenges. But Officer Chervisky and Sergeant Kramer did not undertake an investigation sufficient to address them, because they, 1. Failed to follow necessary leads, including interviewing possible relevant witnesses and collecting evidence. 2. Failed to properly interview Rodriguez, including failing to conduct a trauma-based interview, which made it impossible for them to understand whether she was incapacitated because of her alcohol consumption at the time of the alleged assault. 3. Failed to collect evidence from Pervez, which includes a forensic exam and DNA sample. 4. Failed to interrogate Pervez in a timely manner. 5. Failed to properly interrogate Pervez whether he knew or should have known if Rodriguez could give legal consent, not cross-examining him or seeking to confirm what he said and appearing to favor him. As a result, their investigation was incomplete and failed to find the truth."
We'll walk through what Veronica says happened, according to court filings and expert reports, after a quick break. Veronica met Fahad for dinner on January 7th, 2023. She knew he was a doctor, but not that he was a commissioned officer, which matters a lot in the military. They planned to meet at a restaurant, but it was closed. She asked to just reschedule. He said no, and insisted they try another place. He offered to drive. As they drove, she said he started asking her invasive, sometimes sexual questions, which made her uncomfortable. She pretended to call the second restaurant and actually dialed a number one digit off. Phone records later confirmed this. She wanted an excuse to get back to her car, but when they got to the restaurant, he checked the door and it was open. So they went in. They ordered drinks. He got her a Long Island iced tea, a heavy drink she'd never had before. Veronica was raised Mennonite, and she came to drinking late in life. And during the evening, she also told him she was celibate. She said she was active in her church, that sex wasn't on the table, and everything I've just told you is on tape. Because at one point, Veronica became so uncomfortable with the situation that she felt she needed to record in case Fahad became violent or aggressive. This is where I'll take a little soapbox detour to discuss how most victims of sexual assault have a hard time proving they were assaulted without evidence. Veronica had evidence, the audio recording, and after some urging from friends, she also received a rape kit. According to endthebacklog.org, which was created to eliminate the existing backlog of untested rape kits across the United States,
every 68 seconds, someone is sexually assaulted in the United States. In the immediate aftermath of a sexual assault, a survivor may choose to undergo a forensic medical examination to collect any evidence left behind in the assault. A doctor or nurse will conduct the 4 to 6 hour examination and will preserve this evidence in a sexual assault evidence collection kit, commonly referred to as a rape kit. If a survivor chooses to report the rape to the police, the evidence in the rape kit can be one very powerful tool to bring a perpetrator to justice. First, the examiner obtains a thorough medical history from the survivor. The survivor stands on a large sheet of paper while undressing in order to catch any hair or fiber evidence that may fall from her or his body. The survivor's clothing and the sheet are collected for testing of hair, fibers, and any additional evidence. During the physical examination, any injuries from the attack are documented and treated, and evidence is collected. The examiner collects biological evidence such as saliva, blood, semen, urine, skin cells, and hair. By taking swabs of the survivor's skin, genitalia, anus, and mouth, scraping under the survivor's fingernails, and combing through the survivor's hair, the survivor's body is photographed head to toe to preserve evidence of bruising and injuries. It is important to note that any or all parts of this examination can be declined at any point. When the forensic medical examination is complete, the evidence collected is carefully packaged and labeled to prevent contamination.
Veronica's kit tested positive for DNA, and the multiple bruises and scratches on her body from the interaction with Fahad were documented. As for evidence, I have heard the recording Veronica made, but as she has been convicted of wiretapping, legally, I can't share it with you. Yet. I'm hoping that once the records from her case are unsealed, I will be able to air parts of the recordings, because it gives insight into the night's events. I will tell you my interpretation and impressions of the recording, but you'll have to make up your own mind when you hear it for yourself. I recognized all too well what was happening on the night of January 7th, 2023, between Veronica and Fahad Pervez. And you might too. It was a power play. Fahad had a very specific idea of what was happening, and it didn't match what Veronica thought was happening or what she wanted. Pervez spends most of the night drilling her with questions and waxing poetic about life. He reminded me of Andrew from Love is Blind season 3. If you're not familiar, here's a clip.
I think that's the fear that drove me to start traveling in the first place. 2019, I landed on this new project at work, which was pretty cool. I flew to Paris. The expense account was real flush, so I was renting like nice sports cars every week. So I was stacking up a bunch of cash, and then I was like, fuck it, let's go. 3 months plus in South Africa and like a month in Namibia, and then 3 months in Bali, a month in Singapore. Oh. That was a different avenue of growth. Alain de Botton he writes on marriage and love. He says that compatibility is a desired outcome of love and marriage, not its precondition. He says the two people are ready to get married when they realize that they're fundamentally incompatible for each other.
Ugh. Fahad was pompous, controlling, mansplainy, invasive, and overtly sexual throughout the whole night. While Veronica came off as uninterested, conciliatory, and just trying to appease him so she could go home. When Veronica did engage with him discussing her religious background, Fahad responded, quote-unquote, "religion is dumb." Veronica says she started to feel more drunk than she'd ever felt, like she couldn't form full sentences. At one point at the restaurant, she says she went to the bathroom, but felt like she was blacking out. She couldn't sit on the toilet properly, like there was more in her drink than just alcohol. Fahad paid the more than $100 check and they left. Veronica thought this was the end of it, that he would just take her back to her car and she could go home. But instead, she said he took her glasses off and told her she looked more beautiful without them. And then he hid them from her. When they got back in the car, he said he wanted to go on a drive. Fahad drove and continued to pepper her with sexual questions. She asked where her glasses were because she couldn't see anything. Fahad said, quote, "I have them. I'm not giving them to you yet," end quote. He leaned in and kissed her so hard her nose bled. They drove to a gas station so she could take care of her nose with tissues and nose spray. And then he touched her chest, rubbed her neck, and she told him, quote, "I'm good, like, I'm fine. You don't need to do that," end quote. He tried to kiss her again, even though her nose was bleeding. She told him not to kiss her. Veronica asked to go home, and Fahad said no. Instead, Fahad drove them to a wooded area. She said he tried to put his hands down her pants, and she stopped him. He joked that he was a doctor and it was for quote-unquote medical reasons. She said, quote, "No, it's not," end quote. From the recording, Fahad sounded aroused, like he might be pleasuring himself and trying to get his pants off. Veronica said, quote, "I like you, but are you going to be mad if we don't have sex?" end quote. He said no. Then he pulled off his pants and pulled her onto his lap. She said, quote, "Okay, no, no," end quote. He replied, quote, "I'm not doing anything. I just want to," end quote. What happens next, she said, was rape. This too was recorded. Veronica can be heard saying, "Ow, ow." Afterwards, they sat in the car and talked about movies. Then the headlights of a police cruiser approached. Fort Indiantown Gap security pulled up. Veronica and Fahad gave their IDs. The officers logged it as a trespassing warning and moved on. Fahad told Veronica not to tell anyone what happened and that he's, quote, "being a bad doctor," end quote. And, quote, "we can't even hang out. We can't even talk. So this is off the record. You know that, right?" end quote. Fahad is referring to their military status, which doesn't allow for fraternization ever, but especially between a high-ranking officer, a major, and a low-ranked National Guard nurse. At the time, Veronica had no idea Fahad was a major. And at first, Veronica didn't call it rape. Hirschman's report says she tried to make it make sense in her own head. She didn't want to believe it was that bad. She even texted him, even said she had a good time, told a friend she was a willing participant. The friend didn't buy it and called her to ask what really happened. 3 days later, Veronica got a call from her sergeant asking about the incident. That's when she learned Fahad was a major, which made their contact a violation of military policy. Veronica filed a report, and that's when things really started turning against her. More on this after a quick break. According to Carlton Hirschman's report on Veronica's case,
on January 13, 2023, Rodriguez and sexual assault advocate Charity Harmon from the state of Pennsylvania arrived at the Indiantown Gap Police Department for a follow-up interview with Officer Chervisky and a Sergeant Kramer. Rodriguez gave Officer Chervisky and Sergeant Kramer the clothes she was wearing during the night of her assault. She also gave her mobile phone to Officer Chervisky. Rodriguez gave her consent to have her mobile phone processed. Officer Chervisky read Rodriguez her Miranda rights when she gave up her phone for downloading. Why? Was she a suspect for recording Pervez without his knowledge at this stage of the investigation? She was not in custody. Why did Officer Chervisky and Sergeant Kramer conduct a data dump of Rodriguez's cell phone and not Pervez? Officer Chervisky stated, "I asked her a few questions regarding her military status. I asked her how long she had been in the Air Guard. She replied 2 years. I was shocked she had not attended basic training yet and asked why. Rodriguez explained she has had 4 different medical profiles so far that have prevented her from attending basic training. She then shares she is pretty sure this case has created another profile for her and will prevent her from attending training until the case is closed. Harmon made a statement about her injuries, and this sexual assault, it may place her at 100% VA benefits." Officer Chervisky takes Rodriguez's statement as a negative and uses it to discredit her. He misses the point of the statement and believes it is evidence of false reporting. Consent to sexual contact is rarely telegraphed as a direct yes or no. Rather, it is communicated through indirect statements, body language, and physical actions. "I have interviewed, interrogated hundreds of suspects in sexual assaults. This defense is common. The consent defense is the number one defense in non-stranger sexual assaults. In this case, Rodriguez was unable to give legal consent due to her incapacitation. Officer Chervisky and Sergeant Kramer should have focused on this aspect of the investigation." Officer Chervisky and Sergeant Kramer never explored in depth what Rodriguez and Pervez discussed before Pervez initiated sexual contact. It is common that suspects of sexual assaults will state the victim initiated the sexual contact by kissing. These statements always make it appear the victim had given consent to have sexual contact. Officer Chervisky and Sergeant Kramer never confront Pervez about his self-serving statements. They simply document his statements and move on. None of Officer Chervisky and Sergeant Kramer's questions could have been used to determine the presence or absence of consent when asked of Pervez.
Instead of analyzing the recordings for signs of duress or incapacitation, the police used Veronica's recording against her. They charged her with wiretapping and filing a false report. They claim she recorded the night with the intent to fabricate a story, that she lied to implicate Fahad. That's a lot to go through, to fabricate a story about a dude she's only had dinner with once, and for what? So she could be dragged through the mud and blamed or punished by the military? Let me just tell you, as a woman, yeah, no. The police pointed to friendly text messages between Veronica and Fahad, including one text that was a photo she sent him afterwards, of what they said were her breasts. But Hirschman's report said it was a cleavage shot to show bruising, with a caption that read, quote, "looks like I got beat up," end quote. The photo was in the police investigation report, but shockingly, it was left out of the affidavit. And in all the time that the police were investigating Veronica, there didn't seem to be much investigating of the man she'd accused of rape. It reminded me of the interrogation, I use this word in quotes, the Alabama police conducted of Sweet Tea, an influential white guy who was accused of raping Megan Rondini. Here's a clip of the interrogation so you'll have a better picture of how some police departments handle investigating men for sexual assault and rape.
Sorry, guys.
That's okay. No, that's all right.
Get y'all out of here.
There we go. We went fishing. What day did we fish?
Fishing right in the morning.
Thing biting?
Yeah.
Really? It's snapper season in the state waters right now, so we went out.
Had a killing, huh?
Yeah, we caught it, 30 minutes?
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
30 minutes?
It took us 45 minutes to get there and 30 minutes to get
there. The investigator gave his statement to him.
So y'all end up having consensual sex. She never said no, never said stop. She was completely into it. Is that right?
That's correct. If any, you know, be honest, she was extremely flirtatious from the time we picked her up.
Okay. So it was a willing.
It was a willing participant.
Okay.
Both ends. Y'all did y'all's job, and I appreciate it.
Well, I look at it, man. If it was me on the other side, I'd want to do the same thing for me.
I did. I appreciate all y'all. Y'all done a very thorough job, and I appreciate it.
I appreciate it. I appreciate you being cooperative. I know it's not something easy, and you too, man. You know, he's always. Always been easy to deal with, I'm telling you, always. I wish they were all that easy to get a hold of when you two. Y'all give me just a second, I'll be right back.
Okay.
When the detective leaves the room, Sweet Tea and his lawyer continue the conversation.
If they can communicate that to her, I won't pursue her. She don't pursue me, but I will play hardball if she does.
Fahad's phone was never searched, nor was it confiscated by the police. Hirschman said police didn't interview the bartender at the restaurant. They didn't check surveillance footage. They didn't even do a monitored phone call between Veronica and Fahad. They didn't compare his military statement to his police interview. They even told him his military statement, quote, had nothing to do with them, end quote. That is unheard of. The police told him up front they had sufficient evidence before even asking a single question. As Hirschman wrote, quote, no competent investigator would ever tip their hand like that, end quote. And here's the wildest part. According to Hirschman, the suspect asked Veronica to lie about what happened. That detail? Never followed up on. Never questioned. Hirschman called it one of the biggest investigative failures he'd ever seen. And when the trial came around under a heavy gag order, which kept Veronica from speaking about her own case, the judge ruled Hirschman himself couldn't even testify. What is with judges excluding experts these days? Judge Bev Cannoni did it in the Karen Reed trial with Michael Easter, the retired FBI agent who was going to testify about how a crime scene should actually be handled, not the way the Canton and MSP Keystone cops handled it. And now Judge Jones, in this case, is doing it here. How is Hirschman's expert testimony irrelevant to Veronica's state of mind and correct techniques for investigating a sex crime? In the motion to dismiss Hirschman's testimony filed by the prosecutor's office, quote, Carlton Hirschman's report appears to be largely a critique of the police investigation that was conducted and provides an opinion that had a better investigation been completed, police would have been concluded that the defendant was a rape victim, end quote. And that's wrong or shouldn't be allowed? Shouldn't we want the police to do a thorough investigation to make sure we have the right person so that a sex offender isn't running around possibly looking for his next victim? To me, it sounds like the judge makes Hirschman irrelevant to help the prosecutor. Pierre Hesgraf, whom we'll get into in another episode. Hirschman's 39-page report, however? Yeah, that's fair game. Veronica's team could use it to cross witnesses. So why not let Hirschman take the stand if they can use his words in his report? As Judge Jones puts it, quote, you can't decide whether it's a false report unless you understand whether a rape happened, end quote. And the jury did decide. On May 23rd, 2025, Veronica Rodriguez was convicted on all charges, filing a false police report, and 2 counts of felony wiretapping for recording her alleged rapist without his consent. The jury deliberated over 2 days before returning a unanimous verdict. Directly after the verdict, prosecutor Pierre Hesgraf got out in front of the narrative as the gag order was finally lifted. She spoke to a sparsely populated press room, but every local news station covered her quote-unquote press conference. Veronica, meanwhile, is still being advised to not speak about her experiences, as anything she says could be used against her in her sentencing. Here's Hesgraf in her press conference.
Why would she record this at all? That was my question at first. Why would somebody do this? It just seemed bizarre to me. Well, going through her phone evidence, and I can tell you, it took me about 4 weeks to go through her phone. What we also found in her phone is she stalked the victim on Instagram before their date. So she knew he was technically married, and then she discusses with our victim during the date on the recording what's going on. And the victim tells her he's separated. So she starts making this recording just like she does for every other man that she deals with. And now she has it. The difference is in this case, she has to talk to her supervisor, and this now becomes, well, if I cry rape, I'll get out of getting in trouble. So we used initials as best we could because it's not these men that are at issue here, it's her. But the person that actually recruited her into the guard, married, she slept with him. And during her testimony, it was actually one of the most, I would say, shocking portions of it. She got on the witness stand, and one of the first things she talked about was that gentleman and that relationship. And she indicated she offered him, again, in her words during trial in front of this jury, she offered him a blowjob at the county fair. But hey, she doesn't sleep where she works. She has an ongoing relationship with NW, a fellow guard member. There's an ongoing relationship with an Air Force officer. And right up until this incident goes on with the victim, she's in a relationship with JT, who is a sergeant in the Army.
So Pierre Hesgraf came out swinging by slut-shaming a woman who says she was raped. Granted, a jury did not find that that was credible, but is this really what we're doing? Like I said, I'll have more on the prosecutor Pierre Hesgraf in another episode. There's a lot to unpack there. For now, my immediate reaction is I guess I shouldn't be shocked when a prosecutor slut-shames a woman, but this comes off as way over the top and incredibly defensive about the case that she put on. Judge Charles Jones did allow Veronica to remain free on bail while she awaits sentencing, which is currently scheduled for August 20th, 2025. Her legal team says they intend to appeal, and that's where we are. Veronica has been through trial, she's been convicted, and now she's waiting to be sentenced on August 20th by a system that right now seems more interested in silencing her than listening to her. But you know who is listening? All the others watching quietly, wondering if they should ever come forward after an assault. That's who. There's a lot more to this story, and we'll go deep on the next In Between. Until next time, be good people, don't do murder, and keep your hands off others until they give you their full consent. The In Between podcast is written, edited, and hosted by me, Mel Barrett, and is a production of Ruby Grace Productions. If you want ad-free exclusive content, bonuses, and lives, head on over to the In Between podcast Patreon and sign up. The researcher level starts at $6, and there's already 20-plus ad-free episodes for you to binge right now. Special thanks to Amber Hunt for editorial guidance, as well as the rest of the team at Grab Bag Collab, Amanda Rossman, and Daisy Egan, for their support and guidance. Another special thanks to Rebecca Lavoie for her friendship and mentorship. You can catch me and Rebecca recapping the Karen Reed trial on the Crime Writers On, The Readathon. Follow the In Between podcast on Blue Sky, Facebook, and YouTube at In Between Pod, and on Instagram at The In Between Pod Official. On TikTok, you can follow me at Jack of All Trades DC. Thanks for listening.